I have one of those Dark Night of the Soul moments in every race, and I had it at Brazos Bend, oh, probably right before the sun came up, about 4 in the morning. And I was like, I was just feeling that fifth loop out of six. It was just like, no, this is, I am not loving this. And then the sun came up and I put on some new tunes and I'm singing and I'm running down the trail and there's these big gators there and I'm taking pictures. And, you know, it was like a new day. And I was like, how does that happen? That's ridiculous. I have just run 85 miles and then that happened. If I had given up on myself, like when I've trained people, I used to coach a lot of Ironman athletes. And when I trained them, some of them would give up too early or drop too early in races. And I have this thing that I put in all this hard work and sacrifice and give up a lot of things over time and training so that I can do this event. And I just think that athletes who give up on themselves too soon, they really need to respect their training self.
Hey, welcome back to the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast, where we talk about what it takes to go the distance in running and in life. I'm your host, Eric Dieter. I'm an ultramarathon runner and a mindset coach. When trail runners get together to run a few miles, we never know where the conversation is going to go. So if you're ready, let's get started. My guest this week is Mandy Miller. Mandy has been running for a long time, and she's got a variety of experiences and adventures all over the world. She's run desert stage races and Arctic stage races. She's run ultramarathons, marathons, triathlons. I also found out after we were done recording that she's a published fiction author. Her first book, States of Grace, is for sale on Amazon. I read it. It's a good fun read. Really had a lot of fun with this conversation, learning and hearing about Mandy's adventures. Hope you enjoy my conversation with Mandy Miller. Well, I appreciate it, Mandy, being here. You and I met on a trail at the very end of your 100K. But usually before, and I usually have a time of asking a guest who they are. And so since I feel like I know you, I was going to just like jump in and
yeah, that's good.
And so I caught myself this time. And so I won't get too far in. Tell a little bit about, who you are and how you came into, running.
Well, let's see. I've been running for a long time. So, probably coming on for 40 years, I guess, which is a long time.
That's a pretty good, yeah, that's I know, a pretty I good long
think,
time. Yeah.
I don't want to think about that. So in high school, I'd always been athletic. I was on the swim team. I played on our tennis team, squash, all kinds of things. I'm originally from Scotland. So I went to school in Europe and spent a lot of time in boarding school in Scotland. And I was athletic. I played field hockey. I did whatever was around depending on the time of the year. I was not a runner. I was always a chubby kid. So on the chunkier side, even though I was pretty athletic, I was pretty chunky. And then after college, while I was in law school, I just seemed to be putting on more weight from just sitting around, obviously, and studying. So I lost a bunch of weight. I lost like 60 pounds in 11 weeks. So it was like the ultra diet.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
That is a fast weight loss.
Yeah. I was young then though. I can barely lose 5 pounds now if I need to. So I was like about 200 pounds. So I'd gotten, and I'm not very tall, so I'm only 5'4". So I'd gotten quite unhealthy just from sitting and getting no exercise. So I lost all this weight. And after I lost the weight, that's when I started running. So I just got this little pink pair of Saucony running shoes. And this was 1984 in Chicago. And then the very next year, 85, I ran my first marathon.
Wow.
And that was that. I've just been running pretty much ever since then. I've done a lot of long distance triathlons. So a lot of, I started in running, marathon running, then eventually it kind of burned out on it. And then I went to triathlon, which of course led to the even more extreme Ironman and then Ultraman. And so it just got longer and longer because I turned out I was much better at things that were longer, even though I'm only good at things that are painful. so it's really annoying. So then I did Ironman for a lot of years and I just got tired of the direction the sport was taking. So a good friend of mine, Bob Becker, who's the race director for the Keys 100 and other races, had suggested that I might like to sign up for Marathon de Sable, my first ultra,
okay.
7 days in the Sahara Desert.
Okay. Okay.
I think there was some beer involved. And
those decisions often happen to ultra marathoners. Yeah. Yeah.
There was beer involved. And so I did, I signed up for Marathon de Sable in 2009, April 09, and that was my first ultra.
Wow. Okay. And so that was a multi-day.
7 days.
Seven days.
Yeah.
Now there's another one. I've seen several races in various deserts. So you said this was mm-hmm. in the Sahara.
Yeah.
There was one I read about called Run to the Wreck. That's not.
No, Marathon de Sable is kind of like the granddaddy of a multi-day self-sufficient type ultra racing. Then there's a company called Racing the Planet, and they have the four deserts or the five deserts, I guess it is. They have Atacama, Gobi, Sahara, Antarctica, and Namibia maybe. So there's that. And there's a few other stage races. I've done Grand to Grand. I've done another race in Utah, Desert Rats. I've done one in Spain. I've done a lot of stage racing when I sit down and think about it.
And those have, they're multi-day. Now you said self-supported. Does that mm-hmm. mean you have to carry everything
yes.
with you or do they... So some of the stage races I've seen is like it's almost like glamping. You know, they give you
right.
campsites and set up the tents and self-supported sounds a little bit more.
You have to carry everything. Yeah, they give you, well, at Marathon de Sable, they give you, we'll call it a tent. It looks more like a lean-to kind of dealy bobber. It's a Bedouin. There's a Bedouin crew and they put up these tents, and they're just basically posts with some sort of covering. They don't have sides and they have rugs. And so they fall down in a sandstorm. As soon as you get a breath of air, they fall down. And you have to carry all your food for 7 days, mandatory amount of calories and gear. So, it's a lot of strategy and what you have to have and what you want to have because uh-huh. the pack gets real heavy.
Yeah, I would imagine.
Yeah, you have to have your sleeping gear in there too. So your sleeping bag, your sleeping pad. So of course the food goes down every day. So the mm-hmm. weight goes down. It's hilarious on the second day of these races. You just see like people throwing stuff out of their packs that they don't need. There's a Bill Bryson book about the hiking the Appalachian Trail.
Actually, yes, and people who hike those trails, they say at the beginning, there's always gear along the trail.
Yeah, because his friend has this huge pack, Bryson's pal, and he's a big smoker, and he just like on the night he's like primal screaming into the night, throwing stuff off a cliff. And that's kind of how some of these stage races go after people have carried the pack for one day. And then there are other races like Desert Rats I did last year, which is in Utah. And they provide wonderful food, a cook, and you can bring your own tent or you can sleep in their tent. So you only need a day pack. You don't need all that stuff.
So the Sahara Desert, any desert race, do they provide water?
Mm-hmm. They provide this lean-to tent and water. And that's what you get for your $4,000, basically. But it's, I'm sort of making fun because Patrick Bauer, the race director who's been doing this, I think MDS has been going for almost 30 years. It's amazing. There's almost 1,000 runners. It moves like the military through the desert. Camp has to move every day. It's an incredible undertaking to put these races on and to have enough people to just physically move the camp day to day. So there's a lot of expense. Mm-hmm. Yeah. When I did it, it was 800. And I believe I learned last year it was up over 1,000. So it's like a whole city. It's like Burning Man, but without the fun and much more pain.
And no music, I would imagine.
No, there's, it's a real challenge, and it's really an incredible experience.
Yeah, I imagine. I've seen videos of various desert races and stage races, and it's one of those things that I've kind of had on my mm-hmm. bucket list. Is like, that looks like it would be fun.
Well, the Desert Rats race, which is put on by Gemini Adventures, a guy who lives here in Colorado, he puts on a lot of races every year, but his stage race is called Desert Rats. It's 150 miles, basically from Fruta in the far west of Colorado all the way to Moab. So it's over very different terrain every day. And that's kind of a good, I don't want to say starter stage race. It sounds stupid, but,
well, if they're providing food and, yes. and tents, I mean, that'd be a big thing to
and they're awesome beginner. People. It's small. It's like a little family. You get to know everyone. You can bring your, my husband volunteered and he brought our truck and we slept in a tent in the back of the truck. You can do whatever you want beyond just doing the mileage. It's up to you, however you want to spend the week. So it's basically a catered week of camping with 150 miles of running included.
Okay.
And it's really it's a good way to see what it would be like to be out there for a week running that far, particularly with a couple of the long stages. And if you like it, then sort of graduate up to the ones that are self-supported like MDS or Grand to Grand.
Yeah, and I'd imagine, I mean, only having run ultras, I've never run multi-day events. I imagine there's some strategy, and I mean, what are some of the things that differences yeah. between like the stage races that you have to think about versus, say, a 50, 100, 100K, 100 miles?
Yeah. Well, there's usually at least one very long stage, and that's usually in the neighborhood of 50 miles.
Okay.
Also, a lot of these desert races, obviously, it's the desert. So mm-hmm. it's very hot. So you have to be acclimated or try to be acclimated to the heat. Setting aside the issue of carrying the gear, in terms of body management, that's the game. The game is to keep your body together and your feet in one piece for the entire time. And there's a lot of trial and error in that. I have some really bad foot porn from Marathon to Saab. But you really have to start out so slow. Because people do start out too fast in the first couple of stages, and then they're just fried for the rest of the week. And it's meeting out your energy very slowly over the week. It's hard to do that. But also, eating as much as you can is obviously important because you're going to lose weight no matter what. And taking care of your feet. Knowing how to take care of your feet. If you get blisters or you get all whatever happens to your feet, that by the end, they're going to be like hamburger anyways, but, You know, usually you've only got one pair of shoes. Desert rats, you can have a gear bag. So I took extra shoes, and that was such a luxury. But when you only have one pair of shoes and you're putting them on every day and you're indulging those places where you tend to get blisters, it can become pretty painful. Mm-hmm. So managing your feet, managing your energy, starting really slow, knowing the course and where to spend, you know, where you can speed up, where to slow down. I mean, I like it because it's a lot of strategy.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And the thing that I thought about is, you know, I know how I feel after, you know, an ultra marathon, having to get up the next day and run again. I mean, that would mm-hmm. be a,
mentally
that would be a whole
that's hard. Yeah, just keeping your mind in the game. It's easy to have it all be overwhelming. I mean, I think one of the keys to any ultra, particularly 100 miles, is staying in the moment, not thinking ahead, not letting the magnitude of the distance, the terrain, the pain, having sort of managing it just in the moment. And that is even more important in a stage race, because once your mind goes and you get discouraged, it's very hard. I mean, you're at such a low ebb, you're low on calories, you're low on energy. It's very easy to become disillusioned.
Mm-hmm. So are there cutoffs for each day?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, there's cutoffs along the days and there's cutoffs for each day. There tend to be pretty generous. If you can't make the cutoffs, chances are you might want to do a little bit more training before you sign up. If you just don't, because the longer you're out there every day, the longer you're out there, right? Then the less time
right.
you have
mm-hmm.
to rest.
Yeah.
So in Marathon des Sables, there's a rest day after the 50-mile day.
Okay.
But if you don't hurry up on the 50-mile day, you don't get a rest day. I mean, and Marathon des Sables too, there's a lot of Europeans do it, a lot of Brits, and there's a lot of walkers. And mm-hmm. that, you know, surprised me a lot, but, you know, there's particularly English folks are really into walking and hiking. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if you're a fast hiker, you can make all the cutoffs. You don't have to be a runner.
Yeah. And it's for, you know, for a 50 mile, I mean, at a very slow pace, I mean, you can usually do that in 15, 16 hours.
Right.
If you manage your time and manage your energy well. Mm-hmm. And really that's a lot of walking. I mean, for that pace. So.
Yeah, it is a lot. But, you know, if you were doing in Marathon des Sables, if you had a 15 hour long day, you'd be doing well, because one of the other things you can do at MDS is they set up a camp that the average runner will probably get to by dark on the first day of that long stage. And some people just cut it in two. They just sleep for 3 or 4 hours.
Okay, yeah.
And then go on. So they've kind of had a rest already. Mm-hmm. So, you know, depending on the weather, and I got caught in a sandstorm on the long day and we got lost, and it was a very long day.
That would be.
it was like a 23 hour day. We got lost in the desert because someone had stolen the flags, and there was like four or five of us. It was hilarious. Wandering around, lost in the night, came upon a donkey tied up to something. And I was with these two English guys. It was hilarious. I was with them. And one had a walking stick and he was limping. So we just looked like we were a sorry crowd. And one owned a tropical fish shop in London. I remember that. And they were hilarious. They were straight out of Monty Python. So here we are. you know, going around the desert, quoting Monty Python, just laughing our asses off because we were so lost. And it was pretty scary because we were really lost.
Yeah, well, yeah, lost in the Sahara doesn't ever sound like a good thing you want to have to say.
And I do have a penchant for getting lost. I've gotten lost on a 1 mile loop course before. I did this 1 mile loop course on an island in Florida. And, you know, my thinking is whatever looks longer, that's probably going to be the way to go. And this took me down this pier, and the race director's waving at me going, "You're going the wrong way. How can you get lost on a loop?" I do, because I'm just having a nice time and then I lose track.
Well, how many loops? I mean, if it's a loop race, I mean, how many loops did you do?
It was a 6 hour race. So
a 6 hour race. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it was a 1.234 loop. And so in 6 hours, I probably got about 50K, I guess. I'm guessing something like that.
Yeah. And that's 3 hours, you know, about 3 hours on a loop course, and your mind is not really sharp. I mean, I can see getting lost on.
Yeah. And you know, it was funny. I ended up winning that race, and I only won by 385 feet.
Oh my goodness.
because when the race is over, a horn goes off and you plant your stake.
Okay.
And so I planted my stake, and then Bob goes out, the race director, and measures where everybody is on the last loop to count it into their time. And it turned out I was only 385 feet ahead of the woman behind me. So I almost lost it simply by getting lost.
Well, you would have been farther ahead had you not gotten lost, I would imagine. Yeah,
exactly. It was cutting it a little close. I had no idea. Because when you're going in circles, you keep passing people and you don't know where people are.
Right.
So they may have taken a break and sat out for a couple of loops while I'm out there, or vice versa. And so you don't know who your competition is, really.
Yeah. Yeah. This Saturday, I'm going to be doing a loop. It's just a local, I mean, my running group, they call it the Shoustis, and it's a sunrise to sunset, the Saturday nearest the solstice. And so we run, it'll be 9 hours, but it's a quarter mile trail.
Oh my gosh. Oh. And like those like 6 days in the dome or whatever just sounds awful to me.
It does sound awful.
But for somebody who gets lost, it might not be so bad for me. But
yeah, quarter mile, it's kind of hard to get lost on a quarter mile.
It's
got a little bit of elevation. I think it's about 100 feet. Or so elevation, and it's just a quarter mile loop. And it's a big party. So those are fun.
But, yeah.
So when did you make the jump from, did you go into longer ultras right after the stage race, or did you do just stage races for a while?
Yeah. It's like how I am about everything. No volume control. yeah. So Marathon des Sables was April 2009. And the very first standalone ultra I did was that May. So the next month.
Okay.
So I did so my
just
first. Jump, 50.
You just jumped right in and says, this is a great thing. Let's do it.
Well, the race director was the guy who convinced me to do Marathon des Sables in the first place. So then after I'd done it, I thought, well, I have all this training. He has this 50-mile race. Maybe I'll go try that. And so I did my first 50 right after that. And then it pretty much took off from there. I'm not one of these people that does, 30 ultras a year or something, but, a handful every year. And I've kind of kept with it.
And so you started in 2009. So you've been mm-hmm. at it for a while then.
Yep.
Yeah. So were you running roads then before that?
I was living in Florida. There was one hill. It was called Mount Trashmore. It was the dump.
Okay.
So I used to run up and down the dump. They put, grassy covering on
grass over it, right.
And it was a couple of miles, a loop around Mount Trashmore. And that was the only place really to run near where I lived that had dirt, and some hills. I could do hill repeats, and I ran a lot in the sand when I lived in Florida because there was no trail. So I ran the beach a lot. But I had been running roads pretty much up until that time.
Okay. Yeah. So then first ultra, then what was your, when did you do your first 100?
Well, I tried to do 100. I failed at my first attempt, which was Rocky Raccoon. And I think that was probably 2012, maybe 12, something like that, right around there, 11 or 12. And I probably had no idea what I was doing, so I ended up dropping.
Most of us who start on 100, jump from 50 to 100 is a pretty significant.
Yes, it is. Huge. But then the very first 100 I did, so there's a story to this. The very first 100 I finished was the Yukon 100, which is self-supported in the Yukon, 50 below, with all your equipment in a sled that you pull.
Okay.
So that was my first 100 finish. And so my friend that I had met at Grand to Grand, my tent mate, she and I were the same age. She was super experienced adventure racer. She had done Primal Quest, Eco Challenge. She's like, oh, we should do 100 together. And I'm like, oh, okay, let's do something different, you know? So we're like, okay, let's go to the Yukon and do in January and do the Yukon 100. So we did. And we're out there. I mean, the sleds were heavy too, because there's a lot of mandatory gear.
So yeah, I'd imagine at that kind of, you know, the kind of temperatures in January in the Yukon.
Oh, yeah.
So Yukon is Canada. Is that?
Yeah.
Okay. That's.
And it's just incredibly beautiful in the wintertime. It's amazing. Very little daylight. So you get about 3 hours of daylight.
In January is, I was going to ask if you were at that place where you were in the dark all the time.
Oh, most of the day. Yeah. Most of the days. And the race director is this German fellow, and he's very Teutonic about his preparation. He likes everything to be just so. And so he makes you do this wilderness course to prove that you can survive alone in the wilderness for at least a day, make a fire, because you're in the Yukon, you're usually somewhere between 5 and 10 hours from help. So you have to be totally able to take care of yourself. So there's a lot of equipment. So there was a lot of learning on how to do that. So my friend Mary and I are running along in the night, and I'm having these incredible hallucinations. And we're chatting, and I'm like, hey, do you see that guy over there? And she's like, what guy? Just crazy stuff. And then we were getting to know, I mean, we knew each other relatively well, but she lived in Canada. And this was the first long time we had spent together. So she says to me, oh, so what are there hundreds of you done? And I said, oh, none. This is my first. And she's like, no, you have to be kidding me. And I'm like, no, I'm really not. And it was amazing. I mean, I loved it. It was so hard with a really heavy sled and the temperatures being as they were, but it was amazing. And so that was my first 100 finish.
Wow. So what was the time? Did you have a time cutoff? I'd imagine it was like any other 100, you know, there wasn't really necessarily time built in for stopping and making
camp.
You just kept on going.
Yeah, we thought about camping at 100K at this place called Dog Grave Lake, which I found a little foreboding.
not the best name to go.
No.
He's like, let's spend the night here.
and the sun was coming up just as we came into Dog Grave Lake. And Mary and I looked at each other, and we knew we were about 11 hours from there to the finish, given our tempo. The thought of getting out the sleeping bags, making camp, getting out the bivvies, getting in, getting your boots off and undressed. And so we just said, you know what? Let's just suck it up and move it along. So we did not camp. We had thought about it, and it ended up being the right choice because we were second overall.
Wow.
And we finished in 36 hours for those conditions, and you had 72.
Mm-hmm.
So that is
a great time. Yeah. there are some hundreds that have no snow that have 36
yeah.
hour cutoff.
Yeah, Run Rabbit Run does in my backyard. It's a 36 hour cutoff. I paced my friend this year at that race, and he finished with 17 minutes to spare. so we were running like crazy through the night. But yeah, I was pleased. And I think the reason we did so well was because she was super experienced and we stuck together. And, you know, it was helpful not to lose your mind out there in the total tundra. All alone can be really, I've done other winter races since then, but that it, for the first 100, it could have been pretty intimidating.
Yeah, and you say tundra, it was, so there were no trees. It was pretty vast and open. Is that the,
there was the areas that were like that. Then there was frozen lakes. Then there was a deep alpine forests where you were like in a tunnel. It felt like you were, the trees were there and it was like you were just running through this tunnel. So it was pretty varied and there was a lot of elevation change. So, you know, pulling a sled that weighs 40 pounds up a hill is, you know, it takes some time.
Did you put the sled in front of you when you were going downhill? I mean, how'd you keep it from running into you?
Yeah, that's a problem. I mean, because they do tend to move and hit you in the back of the legs. And this was a rental sled, and it had a pretty sturdy tow bar on it. So other sleds I've used haven't actually been quite as good as that one, even though that one was super heavy. It was a heavy plastic sled. But right at about 97 miles, as we're coming into the finish, there's a 2-mile stretch across a frozen lake. And then there's a mile on the other side to the finish. So I was getting so tired. And it was about 11 o'clock at night. And I'm coming down this hill to the lake, and I totally lost control of the sled. And it came spinning around, and I went flying onto the lake in like these pinwheels. Mary's ahead of me by about 50 yards, and she's going, "What are you doing?" And it was just like spinning in circles on the ice. I didn't have any more power in my legs. I couldn't stand. It was quite funny. And then she waits for me and we're laughing. She's like, "You're such an idiot." So I'm going across the lake, and we look down with the headlamps, and we can see wolf tracks in the ice. And she's like, "I think we better get a move on." And the whole thing was really an epic adventure, and it was so worth it.
So what was it marked? I mean, was it a marked trail? I mean, you said you had going through the woods. It was like a tunnel. So
there
I
were
assuming
markings,
it was a tunnel,
at turns. Yeah. There was no markings, no sort of security markings. There was only markings at the turn. When you had a turn. But the problem with that was it snowed so much that it was kind of hard to see some of the markers. We almost got lost once, and I was very proud of myself. I said that we should go one way, and my experienced adventure racer friend wants to go the other way. And I'm tending to agree with her because she's so much more experienced than me. So we went her way, and then we found out it was the wrong way because I was proud. I could lord it over her that I knew the right way. For a change. We found another guy down the trail who was coming back after having got like 5 miles off course, which no fun in 50 below weather.
Nor when you're adding that on to having to do 100.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but it was an epic adventure, and the Yukon is a stunningly beautiful place.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I bet. So was it like an identifiable trail, or were you...
Mostly, there's so much snow. It was a trail. I mean, I guess you could run dogs on it or snowmobiles
It was kind of obvious where to go if you
pretty
if
much.
You were
there were a couple course, yeah. of confusing parts, and of course that couldn't. Maybe it wasn't confusing. We were just so tired that we thought it was confusing. it was mostly identifiable, and you know, Robert, the race director, is super well prepared. Great information that we had studied, so we had reasonable sense of what direction we were going in, what we should be seeing. So it wasn't the type of trail that every moment you're worried that you're lost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good.
It is good. In 50 below, it's really good because, you know, everything freezes. So,
yeah. And so at 50 below, I mean, what kind of gear did you have to have?
Oh, well, the mandatory gear, it felt like I was like Gilligan's Island or something. The 3-hour cruise that went mm-hmm. wrong. So obviously mandatory gear, 40 below sleeping bag, a bivouac for the bag, a stove, fire making equipment, a saw, an axe to cut down some wood if you need to make a fire. What else? Sleeping pad. I can't remember what the calorie count was, but a lot of mandatory calories. Also, the real tough thing about winter racing is keeping your water from freezing. Our water froze. We didn't have anything to drink except the snow we ate for the last 22 miles.
Wow.
Because
and it's hard to eat enough snow to keep hydrated.
Yes. And everything was just frozen up. The hoses, I mean, we had them under our gear. The hoses were still frozen on the camelbacks. The bottles wouldn't open. I've since learned a trick about spraying Pam or vegetable oil on your bottles, and they open much easier in the freezing cold. But it's almost impossible to keep your fluids from freezing, and also your food. I learned a lot in that race about what works in freezing cold temperatures. You don't want anything that's going to go hard and crack your teeth out of your mouth. Yeah. I mean, things that sound great for most ultras do not work. You need super high fat food that's very soft. Like, you know, if you make brownies with protein powder in them or something and put a lot of butter in them so that they stay soft. Mm-hmm. And then if I would just keep my food for the next course, my next meal, down my sport bra to keep it warm. And it was really funny was when we got to the end, we camped that night at this little place where at the finish, and it's basically a hunting camp. So Mary and I go in there, we just crash, and I wake up in the morning and I have half an egg McMuffin in my sport bra. It's like, man, we were laughing so hard. I'm like, oh, breakfast. I had forgotten I'd put it down there the day before. It was part of my breakfast the day before. And so high fat food, things that stay soft, no bars, nothing like that. It all freezes. You can crack your teeth so easily.
Mm-hmm. Well, typically, for me, I know, especially at the later stages of a race, I always look for soft food. I mean, for, soft food.
Yes.
You know, like, actually, baby food packs work really well for me. And I would mm-hmm. imagine those would, you wouldn't get them out of there.
Anything you can gum down, you know, just nom, 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 sort of mm-hmm. like gummy that you can just sort of break down that you really don't have to chew. But everything. But,
fruit bars, I'd imagine anything that had any kind of moisture in it would turn into a rock.
Totally. M&Ms are like the kiss of death in the Yukon.
Really?
yeah, because they're so hard that you could really crack your teeth. Mm-hmm. But what worked well for me was the little miniature Milky Ways, because they have a lot of caramel in them and that soft nougat. And then I would just stuff them in my pockets and keep them close to my body and then take them out one by one, and they would be soft because they were melting with the heat of the body. So anything that you can put near you to melt works. But it has to be high fat to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm. So have you made pemmican? Did you get
it? I have not. It just sounds so gross to me. It's like some Davy Crockett thing, right? I actually had to ask a friend of mine the other day who used that word, and he's like, pemmican. And I'm like, what is that? And he's like, it's like jerky. I'm like, oh, okay.
Well, sort of.
Okay.
It's mostly fat.
Mostly my favorite ultra food, hands down, no questions asked, is bacon.
Really?
Yep. Cooked bacon. Yeah, I've stuffed my pockets with, I've stolen all the bacon at aid stations. Left no bacon for other people.
That's good. I would like to like bacon. For me, after 50 miles, anything that I have to chew very much, it really doesn't. I have to have soft food. So you know, that's why I do the stuff that's, you know, pureed.
Yeah, I've trained myself over the years to try to go with whatever's at the aid station. Yeah. I'll find something there because I find the fewer decisions you have to make in a 100-mile race, the better off you are. And it's like you're just more focused then on your body, how you're feeling, staying on top of your nutrition. Like if I have to think about this drop bag is in this place and it's got this in it, and it's just it's not simple enough for my mind. I just like things to be more simple and more predictable. So I like, you know, a ham and cheese sandwich or a quesadilla, another great thing. Like at Javelina, they had those. And the race I just did, they had quesadillas. They had mashed potatoes, another great food for ultras. I like salty things more than I like sweet things later in a race.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's so do you have you normally just run by yourself, or do you try to go and have a crew and support?
Well, you know, some races obviously require it and others don't. Like at Javelina, for instance, and then I just did Brazos Bend 100 a couple weeks back. It's 6 loops, so it's a really good race to do alone. You don't have to worry about having a crew. You can have your own little aid station at the start finish. You don't need to worry about hauling people out there. There were a lot of people with pacers and with crews, but coming from somewhere else, I didn't have that. And I like it. I like going as simple as possible. I don't like having to think about too much about other people. I have to be selfish for that period, because, you know, just using that energy to think through some of the decisions related to crew and what is where and what, who needs to do what. I if I have a crew, I really program it in advance. Like I've done Badwater. I've done Keys 100 requires a crew. And it's just so damn hot in both those places that you could not do that race without a crew. You could do it if you were just doing it leisurely going through Death Valley or running down the Keys. But you really do need a crew because the heat is just so incredible. That the crew needs to stop a lot and you just cannot keep enough fluid in. So, I mean, I do like having a crew, and I have a certain crew that I've used more than once, and they're just great fun. And it's a bunch of gals that I'm friends with that we've met through running in different, we all met actually at a running camp now that I think about it. And my husband, it's always Andy and the girls. and you know, they're just lovely people and they're really fun. And so that makes the event so much more enjoyable, really. But in terms of just getting a race done, I don't really need a crew if everything's out there. I like to kind of be alone. So,
okay. So when you're by yourself, I mean, what's your kind of, when you're by yourself, what do you do to kind of keep yourself going? I mean, because if you have pacers, you know, kind of the pacer's job is to kind of keep you from going off, you know,
course,
going off course, going off course, but also helping to keep you focused. I mean, because if you have a pacer, you really don't have to worry about thinking about the time or thinking, you know, exactly. you can just kind of fall in and be in yourself and run.
At Javelina, for instance, I camped on other people's pacers. I would just find some people I liked and that weren't going to bother me too much. I mean, I don't like a lot of talking at all I think it's just such a waste of energy, particularly in 100 miles. So I don't like a lot of talking. But I did find a couple of guys out there who are about my pace, and I just sort of see them on and off, and then I just sort of camp on the back of them for a little while. And that sort of relieved me of having to think about the timing and, you know, the course and everything. But when it's just me, I was saying this after Braz's Bend. I went with, I had a friend down there from where I live. And afterwards, we were talking about how time, if Einstein ever ran an ultra, he might have had different theories about the time-space continuum. Because time takes on this elastic notion. I mean, your mind is like, oh, it's only about 5 hours to go, which is just the most ridiculous thought ever. And then you're like, oh, that was only back there, but back there was like 3 hours ago. And so it just feels like time doesn't really, it doesn't pass the same way. So I spend a lot of time just trying to make sure I'm staying on top of the nutrition. If I have some bodily problem that's coming up, try to take care of it early. Just try to focus. And I try not to fall over because I'm, in addition to getting lost, I'm very clumsy. So I love to fall over. I love to fall over and hurt myself. So I try. One of the reasons I don't talk is because I really do have to focus. I don't, mm-hmm. I don't lift my feet very far off the ground. And mm-hmm. so that can lead to quite some disastrous circumstances.
Yeah. I have the thing with the lifting of feet as well. My feet don't come up off the ground very well. So mm-hmm. did you fall in Javelina? Cause I mean, you and I met in Javelina.
Yes.
And we'd kind of passed each other there. Well, you had 5 miles. We both had 5 miles to go.
Yeah. From that last aid station.
To the finish. We passed each other back and forth. And so I think, you know, after several times I've passed you, I kind of introduced myself and then I didn't ask, but I kind of thought, well, maybe she'd like somebody to kind of follow into the finish line. I never asked your permission. I just kind of stood there.
It was fine. I was glad to have my mind taken off what was going on at that point. Cause yes, I did fall, and not in the dark, at noon, on the one of that exposed part of the loop where you're really out there in the desert. There's a lot of cacti. It's not a particularly technical part, but it was one of those little triangular rocks that tend to like to poke up through the trail. And of course I caught a toe and I went flying and I came pretty face to face with a cactus. I'm glad I didn't fly right into the cactus. Yeah. But I knew it was going to hurt because this is a common injury for me. I've done this multiple times that I fall and I roll on my side and I either tear up the intercostal muscles or break a rib. And I'm pretty sure it was both this time because I still can't get out of bed on that right side without pain in my ribs. So I'm pretty sure it was broken and it was, or more than one probably, it was really painful for quite a while. But now it's fine when I'm upright. It's just the vertical or torquing over to roll over in bed, get out of bed, that kind of thing. But yeah, it was a pretty nasty fall. And then that night when it started to get cold and the cold started to seep into my chest and I'm like, oh, this really hurts. This sucks. But I just needed to be done at that point. And I knew I had this 100-mile race, which is why I was doing that 100K. So I had to hope that I was going to be okay.
Well, and I didn't find out about the broken rib. And I mean, you and I met, you kind of get, you know, we kind of at the finish line said, hey, you know, well, you'd actually given me,
I gave you my info.
Yeah. Gave your info and said, you introduced me to Sabrina Stanley.
Right.
As well. You said that you would kind of, and her episode just released today.
Oh, I have to listen to it.
Yeah.
I think she's a very good interview.
She was great. It was just, and she just was, I mean, just really, very open about who she is. Mm-hmm. And, it just, it was, I really enjoy enjoyed it. And the thing about podcasting is I get to hear it twice, because I always, you know, when we're recording, and then I get to go through and edit and kind of hear. So that's been, that's when I really find out, you know, is it a really great interview or is it just an okay interview?
So, right. Yeah. I've known her since she got into the sports, since she was a baby ultra runner, and she lived in Steamboat where I live. And she and Avery lived here for quite a while. In fact, they lived with us for quite a while when they were leading up to her first Hard Rock before they went off and lived in this tin can, which they called a camper. But I really don't think it was a camper. I think it was really a tin can that had a hitch on it. You're right. She's very, very open, very straightforward about, you know, what her philosophy is. And I particularly like that. I think you and I talked a little about this at the end of Javelina, that it seems to be women athletes have a much harder time declaring their goal, their mission, laying it out there. I mean, that doesn't suit some people, men or women. They don't like to publish it, but other people do like to publish it. But it tends to be men who are stronger and more forceful about their mission and about how competitive they are and how driven they are. And there seems to be some sort of reticence among women to be that declarative. And I just think that I know she's taken some heat for being very, very forthright, very clear about what she wants to do, very clear that she's on that start line to win, not just to have the race and it's her race and she's going to just race her race today. Sabrina Stanley is out there to beat your ass. And that is how it works. And I really admire that. I knew from when I met her to begin with, and I could tell that that was her personality. Probably a lot of it resulted from growing up with big brothers, great bruising athletes. But I knew that this was going to be an issue for her, and it has been. And I'm really glad that she's been faithful to her core identity, because I think that, you know, for women to progress in the sport as men have done, I think you need to go out there and be competitive. That's what people want to see from you. That's what sponsors want. They want people who want to win. And she definitely has that drive, and I really admire that.
Yeah, and that was something that I was glad that she talked about, because it is an issue, and for, you know, from, you know, being a man, I don't know that men have any kind of appreciation for what, you know, a lot of women face in, you know, in ultra running, but also in other areas of life, and it just that, well, and I think there are also, you get heat from women as well. You know, there are women who have the idea that, well, a woman's not supposed to be.
Oh,
that
absolutely. Kind of. I think the worst heat comes from women. It does not come from men. Men will never fault a woman like Sabrina about being out there, about their competitiveness. And I think that chiding only, it's from small-minded people who are threatened by somebody who feels powerful in themselves. And it's not men. I don't think any men would condemn that at all.
Now, men tend to be more, I mean, she's had people, men make comments about her physical, physical appearance.
Right.
the competitiveness is, and especially I think in ultra running, that, you know, you get up in the distances. I know there's been some things written about women in the sport and how the long distance kind of has equalized the playing field for, you know, allowing women to, you know, kind of compete head to head with men.
Right.
And, you know, especially some of the last, you know, the last man standing, mm-hmm. was, you know, was a woman.
Right.
in Lazarus's, right. Backyard ultra.
Right. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So I look forward to hearing that.
Yeah, and it was a great interview. So anyway, but we had talked about that, and we, you know, we had a lot of other conversations. You never mentioned the fact that you've been running on broken ribs
for, and yeah, it happened. It happened on the first loop. I mean, it happened early in the day. It happened like 4 hours into the race.
Oh my goodness.
That wasn't good.
I guess the thing I needed to ask is, what did you do? I'm sure it had to hurt like the whole time. Mm-hmm. So what was kind of your, how did you deal? Because, you know, every ultra runner has times when you have pain. I mean, that's a long time to go in pain. What are the things that you do to kind of get yourself through those?
Well, the other thing was I since I've done this before, I know how it goes. And the worst of it will set in after, once you have stopped. So it did encourage me just to keep moving, to keep warm, you know, to run when I could, on the easier parts of the course to try to click off some miles, because I knew as time went on, it was going to start to hurt more, which it did. By the time the night came, it was pretty painful. But with that, or with any other pain, like, you know, everybody's feet hurt. They always feel like hamburger at the end. You know, your back hurts, your neck hurts. You just can't focus on it. I mean, for me, I sort of, resistance is futile. So I seem to do better when things get really bad. For mm-hmm. some, it's almost like that embrace the suck, that military notion mm-hmm. of resistance is futile, embrace the suck. And you know it's going to be that way. So if you fight it, it doesn't help. So you just have to sort of make friends with the pain cave, and try not to focus on, like, if you got a blister, you know, just don't keep thinking about that one thing. That, you know, try to just, I don't know, that take your mind off of it, but just do your job, maintain your body, maintain your focus, keep on top of the nutrition, keep doing all the things you need to do to be able to finish. And then take a certain amount of pleasure in that, pain. It's kind of a weird thing. Some people can do it, some people can't. But I seem to be able to do that, to really embrace the difficult moments. Because they will pass. I mean, unless, you know, I've got a broken leg out there, I broke my arm, say, that I probably would have quit then. But just sort of welcome, it's going to happen. So, you know, just can't be afraid of it.
Mm-hmm. And what you're saying is you don't ignore it. You don't try to block it out. You don't try to resist it.
No.
But that you don't focus on it either. So you just kind of give a nod to it. You welcome it. You know, there it is. It's there. It's going to be with me. And so now I just kind of accept it and keep on going.
Yeah. My crews have always said to me, like at Badwater, for instance, they're always like, you always are polite. You always say thank you. You're always smiling. And even when it's really bad, I truly believe that if you act in a certain way, your mind follows. So if your body's in pain, maybe if you do smile, maybe if you do reach out to somebody else to help them, maybe you do, you know, your better angels come out. And then you start thinking, huh, it's not really that bad. And you sort of fool yourself into thinking, this could be worse. or you see somebody in worse condition, and you know if you let your mind go, you're going to be them. So mm-hmm. you can't go there. So for me, I just really try to welcome it, accept it as a pain, as a part of the process, and then try to do things that are paradoxical, like befriend somebody else, help somebody else, smile. And often your mind follows. Mm-hmm. Maybe you're so tired, you don't know what a fool you really are and convincing yourself to be such an idiot. But that, to me, that helps. I don't know, that's kind of how I do it.
Yeah. So how did you come across that? I mean, is it something that you've practiced, or how did you discover this was the way to deal with?
Well, I have a PhD in psychology, if that helps.
Okay. Well, I don't know. I know a lot of psychologists who could not figure out something like that.
I've done a lot of research in social psychology, and, you know, one of the early theories that is cognitive dissonance, right? So I find if you turn that on its head and you do something that is dissonant to how your body feels, you can change your mind. You can change your thoughts by a physical action. So I just started to do that, particularly when I started Ironman racing. In the last half marathon of the Ironman marathon, it's always quite a trial. Oh, and I did break a leg once in an Ironman, and I did finish, and it worked there too. yeah, I didn't know I had broken my tibia.
Stress fracture?
Tibial plateau fracture. Which probably was a skiing injury from the preceding season, because right where the break was, you know, like bump skiing when you sink, mm-hmm. and it's a very common injury. And so then I was running on these cobbly streets, and I think it just kind of weakened and it blew. And it was pretty bad during the race, but again, it just sort of soldiered on. But oh my God, afterwards, I'm like, there is something really wrong. I mean, it was the worst pain in my life. And no psychological woo-woo tricks were going to help with that.
Because then you don't have the, there's something about being in the moment and being in, you know, having the goal of that helps push the pain.
Yeah.
Push the pain aside. I mean, it's that when you're done and sit down, then it's, mm-hmm. you don't have the same mental focus. Yeah.
It's like, as soon as you're done with the race, you've just finished running 100 miles. And you can't get to the car. Like 10 minutes ago, you ran 90 to 100 and you were fine. And now you can barely get to the car in the parking lot. Mm-hmm. It's funny how that mindset just, as soon as it's over, it's over. And then the body starts, all the reactions flood in.
Yeah, yeah. So, and after you recovered somewhat, you said you still had sore ribs. You ran mm-hmm. Brazos Bend.
Right, I did.
And you just finished that now. And you said you won?
I wasn't
quite sure when you posted on Facebook what the result was.
So it was the USA Track and Field 100-mile trail championship race. So usually every year they have that trail championship race at a course that's not super technical, which is what I like. Mm-hmm. And I'm good on hills and going up. I'm not a super good technical runner coming down. So it's not kind of my thing, but you know, they've had it at Tunnel Hill. I think they've had it at Brazos Bend. So it's a trail. But it's a trail where people can make serious time. Like, mm-hmm. I think Camille Herron's record there was, it's something ridiculous. And that Mark Hammond won this year in the men's division, and he ran in 14:01.
Okay.
So that sort of shows you what kind of course it is. So it was the age group championship too. So I ended up first in my age group, which was nice, in the USA Track and Field ratings, because I had a USATF number for years from other races I've done overseas that I needed it for. So I'm like, I'm just going to enter that division. Since I have this number, I'm going to enter that division. And it was kind of a nice surprise. I'm like, I'm going to be out there running anyway. So might as well get whatever swag I can get.
So did you know when you were in the race, did you know, you know, kind of that you were in that position?
I mean, had a feeling because of the loops, and there were a lot of out and backs, but there was a regular 100-mile division too, not the track and field championship race. So there were two divisions of the 100-mile race going on, and then all the age groups within that each event. So it was kind of hard. You know how it is too. It's really hard to tell how old people might be. You know,
the older I get, the harder that is.
I know. I'm the same. So I'm like, okay, well, I know I'm old. Who else is as old as me? That is a game I do play with myself, trying to figure out how old people are. And, I sort of had an idea that if I came in somewhere 26, 27 hours, I was going to be in the hunt. And that was true. That was what happened. So it was fun. I like that kind of race because, as I said, you know, I'm clumsy, not super good on technical stuff. So I like to run, I like to run. Like, I've done a lot of 100-mile races or 50-mile races or 100K on super technical terrain, and I just get tired of hiking. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm pretty fast uphill, but
a lot of those 100-mile races, in fact, you know, there's one that and I'd thought about. It's called Outlaw. It's got a lot of elevation. It's in Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. I paced someone there just to kind of see what the course is like. And I thought, you know, there's not much runnable on that whole course.
I just get tired of that. Like, particularly in Colorado and Utah, you know, there's a lot of races that are quite technical. And so there's a lot of power hiking. And I do like power hiking up. I'm probably one of the only people that took 3.5 hours to go up in the Pikes Peak Marathon, and it took me 4.5 hours to come down. Mm-hmm. I'm not a dancer. Like, I'm not real nimble. Like Avery Collins, for instance, or Sabrina, when I've done races locally here, what they've been at, and I've seen them coming off the top of a hill, I'm like, whoa, how do those people do that? You know, they just commit to a line and they go, and mm-hmm. with incredible balance and body control the whole way. And I just do not have that. So I do like runnable courses. I paced my friend at Run Rabbit Run this year, in the night section. So the 12 hours during the night, and we spent the whole night hiking. I was just, mm-hmm. you know, and it wasn't the dark. It was just the technicality of where we were on the course. And, you know, I like to run. If I wanted to hike, I'd go on a hike. I'm not talented enough to be able to run some of the stuff that other people can run. So I do tend to like courses better that are very runnable.
Yeah. Yeah. And the downhills, you know, that is psychologically, it's harder mm-hmm. to come. You know, I slow down on the downhills as well, especially if it's really technical.
Yeah. It's so easy to crash.
Yeah.
And for me, that's not a good thing.
Well, and usually if it's technical enough to crash, I mean, there's a lot of rocks to hit.
Exactly. And you can't see them, like those little ones that just love to like jump out and get you.
My falls, I'm careful enough going downhill that usually when I fall, it's that one little rock or root that's in the middle of a flat trail.
Uh-huh.
And my toe catches it. And there's nothing else. I mean, that's the only one.
That was exactly what happened at Javelina. It was this very cruisy, runnable part of the course. And I must have just been having such a grand old time to myself running along. I didn't see this rock. I caught my toe, and it was the only rock there.
Yes. Those are the ones that get me as well. I know exactly exactly how you feel. So
yeah,
well, that's cool. So what's on tap for you? Do you have any, I mean, you've been running for a long time. You've done some pretty awesome races. Do you have any races that you'd like to say, this is one I'd really love to get into and do?
I've been to Comrades in South Africa.
In South Africa.
I did an up year.
The up year. Okay.
Mm-hmm. I would like to go back and do a down year.
Is there a big difference? I mean, I've heard people talk about Comrades. Is, I mean, a big difference in the way the race flows?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of up in the down still. I mean, but all in all, the up is a much slower course. But the thing about Comrades is it has a 12-hour cutoff. It's a 56-mile race. And at midnight, at the 12 hours, they close the cricket grounds door and you cannot get in. So you basically are shut out. So it was just the most fabulous experience. South Africans are so proud of it. I can see why, because there's so many great South African runners who were precluded from competing internationally for decades because of apartheid. Mm-hmm. So they take a lot of pride in their multicultural race, because this race is certainly that. And also, when you're a foreigner, on your bib, it has your country. And also on everybody's bib, it has how many comrades they've finished. There was an African gentleman that we picked up on the way to the start line in Durban. And he didn't speak very much English, but he was running to the start. And we were about 5 miles from the start. And so we stopped and we saw his bib, and he got in the car and rode with us. And I looked at his bib, and his bib said 32.
Oh, my goodness.
And then I got to talking to him, and he told me he had just run 18 miles from his home to the start, and he was going to run the race, and then he was going to run home from Pietermaritzburg. it's quite – and it's 25,000 people with Zulu warrior bands. And if you're a foreigner, people come by and they're like, how do you like South Africa? Tell us how you like our country. How do you like our race? Because they've had so little outside contact with international athletes that it just makes the whole experience amazing. So I would like to go back to comrades. I'd like to go to Leadville. I've never gotten in out of the lottery, so I put my name in the lottery again this year. I probably will put my name in the lottery for Western next year because we'll have a couple of tickets by that point. So that, just because it's iconic, I've done I've done quite a few iconic races like Comrades. I've done Ironman Hawaii. I've done the Boston Marathon. I've done races that are very iconic of the genre, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. So that, to go to Western and experience that would be really fun. And I think that course, I would like that course because it's not as technical as some, and it's hot. I like the heat. So I don't know, probably that. And, there's a stage race I want to do in Iceland called Fire and Ice.
I have heard about that. Mm-hmm. And isn't there a documentary about that?
Mm-hmm. I'd like to do Fire and Ice. I'm going back to Arrowhead next month, where I've been before, and I have never finished. It's the one race that has had my number. I've never hit the right conditions in that race. As much as I love winter racing,
Remind me where Arrowhead is.
It's in International Falls, Minnesota. So the coldest place on the lower 48 generally in the winter.
Okay.
It's very low. It's Minnesota, so there's a lot of lakes. There's a lot of water. It's incredibly humid. So it gets really cold, sort of. But unless it's really, really cold, the snow gets really mushy because of the humidity. And then you just can't keep your body dry. You're sweating so much. And there's just a whole bunch of logistical challenges with that race. So this will be my fourth try. And I've honestly gotten to the point that – and I have very few DNFs. Three of them are there. But this will be my fourth try. And I have come to be at peace with the thought of Arrowhead, because every time I go there, even if I don't finish, I've met so many amazing people in International Falls. And I've had such a great time every time I've been there, even not finishing. So this year, I'm going to do different strategy. I'll see if I can finish. If I don't, I get to see my friends. I get to see the Northern Lights. I get to plow around in the dark with a sled for 48 hours.
So when is the race?
January. It's Monday, January 31st, I think.
January 31st. Okay. Mm-hmm. So you said it was humid, and I thought that should be cold. You know, I always thought Minnesota would be cold enough that there would be no humidity.
I've never hit that sweet spot where the snow, it's cold enough to keep the snow soft, not frozen. But, the colder it is, the more freezing you get, the easier it is to pull the sled. Mm-hmm. The last time I was there, it was in the 20s, and it was like pulling the sled through mashed potatoes. It was horrible. So I'm really praying. People are like, oh, it'll be so cold. You can manage the cold. What you can't manage is the damp. So I'm hoping that I hit a cold year and I maybe get to the finish line this year. We'll see.
Well, so far in the Midwest, I mean, I'm in Kansas City. We've had record highs. So
yeah.
But I know that can't last.
We've had some snow, but nowhere near as much snow as we normally have had by this time of the year. So it's been pretty warm, a warm fall. So I'm praying for a cold 3 days in Minnesota. And so that's next. And then, yeah, I just sort of keep my mind open. I like to do new things. There's a few races I like to repeat, but not many. I like the unknown. So whatever comes along that takes my fancy, I guess.
So ever thought about the longer distances, like the Moab 240, or they've got a new one now, the Cocodona?
Yeah. No. I haven't. It just doesn't. I don't know what it is. It doesn't grab me. Maybe it will at one point. My friend who I did the Yukon with, she the year before had, or maybe it's the year after, did that 240 somewhere. She loved it, but I don't know. It just doesn't really grab me. Maybe I'm just I'm not really wanting that much pain.
Yeah, and that would hope be, I mean, the 240 is not a stage race. And so, and neither is, I think, the Cocodona.
Right.
And so that, you know, that would not, that would be a whole different than 100.
Totally.
You know, kind of be a brand new thing. And maybe, you know, I've kind of kicked that idea around too, is like, mm-hmm. you know, would a longer distance be something I want to take on? And I haven't decided whether I'm,
yeah,
I think I would do a stage race before I try a longer distance.
I want to do the Camino de Santiago in Spain. And so I kind of would really like to do that. It's just such a big time commitment, mm-hmm. that would need some planning. And oddly, I'm from Scotland originally, as I said, and I've never done any racing in Scotland. So I would like to go and do West Highland Way or, you know, a Scottish ultra. I thought about Cape Wrath, which is a much longer stage race. I think it's 225 miles, something like that, mm-hmm. Over pretty rocky technical terrain in the north of Scotland. So that's kind of out there. But I just sort of go as I, you know, what takes my fancy. If it's open, sign up for it.
Well, thank you a lot for taking time to talk with me. How could, if people wanted to reach out and get acquainted, how can they reach you?
Well, I'm on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. Mandy Miller. I live in Steamboat Springs, Colorado, so I'm easy to find there. I'm on Twitter, and my Twitter handle is @MandyEMiller1. And I'm an author, so my website is my book site, but there's you can contact me through that site. So it's mandymillerbooks.com.
Okay.
And there's a email address there. It's mandy@mandymillerbooks. So that I don't do Instagram. I probably should. I'm a very bad author marketer these days. Social media and I Twitter, I kind of grown to like, and Facebook, I just pretty much keep for two purposes. One is, like you, for instance, my runner friends, people I meet in different places. It's a way for me to keep up with friends in a place where I don't live, and also dogs. Okay. So I do like dog rescue stuff, and I like to post pictures of my dogs. And so, but I'm not a huge social media hound, but I do follow Facebook and Twitter.
So, and your books are on your website. What is your website at?
MandyMillerBooks.com.
MandyMillerBooks.com. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All the info about me and my debut novel's on there. The second one is probably going to come out in about 4 months. And, I have a blog, a flash fiction blog that I probably should pay more attention to. I'm about to do a post, but, you know, so I'm pretty easy to find.
Okay. So you said novels.
Yeah, the series I have going right now is crime fiction. So okay. it's It's called Grace Locke. She's a military veteran with a prosthetic leg and a three-legged dog. So it's dark, it's noir, but uh-huh. hopefully humorous too. So the first book came out in April. The second one is going to come out April 1st, hopefully 2022. And, then I'm working on something, some historical fiction, something entirely different. And I do write for, so I'm a lawyer by profession, but I gave up practicing full time a while back. And now I sort of write for some publications and I write my own books. And, you know, I'm probably going to start teaching college again pretty soon. So that's how I keep busy.
Yeah. Well, and writing is very much like running ultramarathons.
It's so funny you should say that, because in my little bio, you know, my author bio for my books, or when I go speak at a conference or something, I say, you know, in my spare time, I compete in ultramarathons, which is similar to writing a novel in that it requires a lot of patience and a dash of madness. and I find it very, it's interesting you should say that, because I find the process very similar. The need for discipline, the need for commitment and perseverance and patience and pacing, all of those things about writing a book, it's like an onion that sort of, it reveals itself over time. Mm-hmm. And running 100 miles is very similar. You can't bite it off all at once. You have to take care of parts of it in the training and in the racing as you go along. So your point is well taken. And I really do believe that. Of course, it might be really nice if I was really good at running 5Ks and I liked writing 750 words, yeah. but I don't, I'm not any good
most,
at that.
Most readers don't. my wife got into a series and each book was only like 60 pages. And she kept saying, this is not a series. This is a bunch of yes. short stories strung together. It should have been a novel.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, I do try to use the same skills. I think they're very transferable, particularly that patience issue and not overthinking I really am a person who I believe very profoundly in the journey and not the destination. And that's such a cliche. And I'm a writer. I should never say that. But I really believe in process.
It's applicable. I mean, that the reason it's what we say is that it is true.
Yes, I really believe in having faith in the process. And you have to have faith in the process and not be focused on the outcome. If you're somebody who's outcome oriented, or what psychologists call extrinsically motivated, meaning you like the rewards, you like the adulation, you like the attaboys and the medals, and you like those things, and that's what motivates you, chances are you will not stick with ultra running. If you find the process worthy, if you find and you can have faith in that process, and you're intrinsically motivated to push yourself and challenge yourself, and you really don't care about the award. I mean, I just did this race and, you know, it's nice to get an award, but honestly, I almost didn't even stay to pick it up. You know, it's like, it's over at that point. Mm-hmm. And so I like that process orientation of ultra running and writing books it's kind of the same thing.
Yes. Yes. And there also oftentimes comes a point in the book where it's like, when you're 80 miles into an ultra, or 80 miles into 100, and you're wondering why you even started. what yeah. am I doing out here?
yeah. Isn't it funny, though? I think that every race, mm-hmm. that thought at some point does come to my mind. I call it my dark night of the soul moment. Mm-hmm. I have one of those dark night of the soul moments in every race, and I had it at Brazos Bend. Oh, probably right before the sun came up, about 4 a.m. And I was like, I was just feeling that fifth loop out of six. It was just like, no, I am not loving this. And then the sun came up and I put on some new tunes and I'm singing and I'm running down the trail and there's these big gators there and I'm taking pictures. And, you know, it was like a new day. And I was like, how does that happen? That's ridiculous. I had just run 85 miles and then that happened. If I had given up on myself, like when I've trained people, I used to coach a lot of Ironman athletes. And when I trained them, some of them would give up too early or drop too early in races. And I have this thing that I put in all this hard work and sacrifice and give up a lot of things over time and training so that I can do this event. And I just think that athletes who give up on themselves too soon, they really need to respect their training self. They were the guy out there at the butt crack of dawn, you know, putting in 20 miles before they went to work. You have to have respect for that person. And as if that's a different person almost. And then when you come to the race as your race person, you cannot let that race person disrespect that training person and underperform. And I try to keep that mentality of, I should not sell myself short because look at the things I have done to get here. And I would be so disappointed in myself when I have DNF'd. It's so hard. And then I realize it's so much easier to finish than it is to stop. And I try to keep reminding myself of that.
Yeah. Yeah. And then a friend of mine, he was ready to pull the plug, and his wife somehow called his wife on the phone. And his wife said, the future you would not want you to quit.
Exactly.
so you can pull from your training, right, or you can pull from the future as well.
What she's saying is, I do not want to live with you if you quit.
Yeah.
It's like, you will be intolerable for a few weeks. You cannot quit because it will affect me very badly.
That's true.
Because my husband's like that. He knows the times I've quit. And there's a couple of regretful DNFs I have. And it was a total collapse of will. And I sort of pride myself on being a willful person. And when my will collapses and I give up because of my lack of will, I am so disappointed in myself. It's so hard to take. And it has nothing to do with, you know, ending the pain, or it's just like my will just collapsed and I was done for those days. And I still regret them. I'm like, there's an arrowhead, my very first arrowhead, where I had that collapse of will. And I had so much time within the cutoffs. I had plenty of time. I'd had a rest. I was at 75 miles and I had, you know, another 60 miles to go. My will collapsed and I just gave up. And I, to this day, I know that's the arrowhead race I should have finished. And you know, such it is, it's, yeah. That's how
yeah.
it is.
And that's, you know, and you make those decisions and That's part of what I think training your mindset is about. You know, training and setting your mindset to keep yourself from making those kinds of decisions when you really should keep going.
And that's why aid station workers are so important, because a lot of times, you know, you'll just sit there with that 10,000 mile stare and you see somebody come into an aid station if you're volunteering, and you see that look and you know what they're seeing through their eyes. They're just seeing endless nothing and more pain. And then many times an aid station worker will, you know, maybe deal with a particular problem that person has and then encourage them and tell them to wait to drop. And then the next thing you know, that person is finishing and, you know, they would have given up on themselves, but for that little push. You know, so that's, I mean, aid station workers are so, experienced aid station workers are so important that way. There was one guy at Brazos Bend who clearly was a very good runner, like an elite level runner, but he wasn't having his good day. And so when I finished, he finished right around me and he said, oh yeah, I took a 5-hour nap.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. I mean, so we finished in 27 hours and the guy would have finished in, you know, probably 20 hours. But he didn't feel good. So he cut the day in two and had a 5-hour nap. Yeah. I remember one elite triathlete telling me in Hawaii, I met him at a post-race party and he was telling me, he was not at all pleased with his day, and that's how he made his living. But he really learned so much about what it was like to be with the actual mortals, what we have to go through. And I said, mm-hmm. Well, what did you do? Like, you know, I finish in 12 hours and you finish in like 13 hours. What were you doing? And he said, oh, I was sleeping under a table in the changing tent for like 4 hours. He said, between the bike and the run, I just took a 4-hour nap.
Oh, my goodness.
In the changing tent. Yeah. Okay. Well, that was a very good example of, he said that it was his most proud finish because that wasn't him, but he really had to endure to finish.
And to not give up. Especially for an elite, you know, it's like, well, I can't do my normal.
Right.
You know, it would be very easy for them to say, oh, yeah. this is not my day. I'm out of here.
Yeah, and he said that, you know, he just appreciated so much more about how thankful he was to have the talent that he did have, because he saw how incredibly painful it was in the back of the pack. Mm-hmm. And like in Hawaii, nobody there is bad. I mean, everybody within their age group has to qualify to get there. And so, you know, people are pretty good athletes. But then there's that next level. And you know, I was sort of saying to myself, gee, you know, in Hawaii, if you were sort of thinking that those of us finishing in like 12 hours or whatever are the back of the pack, you should come to some other race and see the people who are finishing in 16:59:59, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Cause you said 12 hours. I'm thinking, that sounds like a pretty good time.
Yeah. It was pretty decent, you know? Yeah. But yeah, so it was anyways, you know.
That's great. Well, thank you a lot, Mandy. I appreciate
it. Oh, my pleasure. Thank
this
you.
This has been a lot of fun.
It was a real joy to get to know you a little bit. And hopefully I'll see you out there on another trail. I have done a few races in Kansas. Oh, and I did fall in one in the Flint Hills.
Okay.
So yeah, I wrecked I bled a lot in that race.
Was that the Heartland?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I fell in that really very rocky.
There's
weird
a lot of rocks
surface.
Out there. Yeah. Yeah.
It's not easy. Yeah, that rocky stuff.
Yeah, even though the Heartland, if I remember it, they run those on gravel roads mostly. Mm-hmm.
But this limestone. It's kind of like, or I guess it's the Flint Hills.
The Flint Hills. Well, yeah, there's limestone out there, and there's just a lot of, it's just a very rocky, hilly, you know, and there's no trees.
No, it's very exposed.
Very, very exposed. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, that's a pretty good course.
It has that long stretches where you can see forever, and it seems like that looks like forever.
You see the road, and it looks like it's 50 miles. You know,
exactly.
Away.
Yeah. That makes that hard.
Yeah, yeah. It's hard. It's hard for drivers too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, and I did bike across Kansas several times, and those stretches would, you know, you just like. Seemed like it was uphill for 20 miles, you know. Just going and going.
Yeah. So.
Well, okay. Yeah. If you get out to Kansas,
I'll let you know.
Let me know, and doing the Heartland or something like that, I'd be glad to either run with you or crew
oh,
for
yeah.
you.
That'd be
great.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, thanks, Eric.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, and if you know somebody who you think might like it as well, please just take a minute, send them a link so they can listen. And if you enjoy most of the episodes, tell your friends, that's the best compliment you can give me. I also enjoy spending this time here with you each week, bringing you stories of ultramarathon runners and the importance of mindset. And I also appreciate you take time to listen. If you have any comments or questions or stories you'd like to share, go to ultramindsetpodcast.run. You can send a written message or a voice message. Love to hear from you. You can find the show notes there as well for this episode and all the other episodes there at ultramindsetpodcast.run. Remember, it takes an ultramarathon mindset to go the distance in running and in life. And a strong mindset is a skill you can learn. I am a life coach. If I can help you develop an ultramarathon mindset for whatever epic goal you would like to reach, whether it's running or in life, contact me there at ultramindsetpodcast.run. I'll be glad to see how I can help you reach your goals. Thanks for listening. I will see you next time.